I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week's podcast comes to you in conjunction with Scala Radio, for whom I am a presenter, as indeed is my guest. I'm thrilled to welcome to this podcast the great David Arnold. David, how are you? Where are you? I'm looking at you on a Zoom call and you appear to be entirely surrounded by musical... Well, I can see at least six keyboards and three guitar... What's going on? Where are you?
I'm in my little belfry at Ayr, and I'm working on a thing that we're not allowed to talk about till December. It's not film related, but it is very exciting. So I'm attempting to get that thing written by Christmas. So I'm basically in this in my hole every day until I get it done, desperately waiting for inspiration.
So we should say that this thing that you're doing, I know you can't talk about it, but is it television or film related?
It's neither, actually. It's a concert piece, but it's for a special event. And so it's a proper piece of non-visual related music, which is odd for me because, you know, I think the reason why I got into this job is because, you know, when I see picture, I think of music. And this is a thing where I don't see any picture, you know, I just have a blank page and someone saying, fill that up with an hour and 15 minutes of whatever you like. And, you know, it's the worst thing you can do to me is say, just do whatever you like. It's a bit like, you know, it's like when you go into a restaurant, someone says, what do you want? I say, I don't know, anything. You know, the chef's going to go, well, what is it? I go, oh, anything. Surprise me. So the worst thing you can say is, oh, whatever you like.
So, David, you've done a series for Scala Radio about Bond and the music of Bond. Tell us about the series.
Well, the initial idea was that, you know, whenever Bond comes around, there's always, there are countless, like, programmes and lists of the songs. You know, it's like the best song, the worst song, the most popular song, who should be doing it now, who should be doing it next, who shouldn't have done it, who might have done it and could have done it, and... But there's never really any sort of in-depth discussion about the score, you know, and the score is such a huge part of these things. And indeed, I think, influenced the songs and the songwriting as well. So Scala asked me if I would do a sort of score-by-score breakdown and analysis of every single Bond score that has existed to this point. So I did a lot of listening and a lot of writing, and then I did a lot of talking, and then they broadcast it. I mean, it's not in-depth technically, you know, we don't go into, you know, the horn sound like this because of the way it's voiced, but it's more about the ambience and the point of it and the sound of it and the drive of it and why perhaps it's like that and where it might have led to and where it might have come from. And lots of stories about how these things have, you know, happened and developed and occurred and the various things that have happened over the years. But it was really interesting digging back into those old scores because I haven't really listened to them with it, you know, with a critical ear. I don't think ever really, you know, I never really put them on thinking, right, I'm going to think about why this is like this. I just listen to them because I like them, you know, same reason I like the movies, you know. I tend not to take them apart that much, like I wouldn't with a good sausage.
Sausages and law are the two things that you don't want to see how they're made.
Exactly.
So, obviously, when you were growing up, the Bond movies and the Bond soundtracks were really important to you. Mm. So, tell me about your first falling in love with Bond music. How and why?
The first time was, it must have been in the late 60s, and I was 7 or 8 years old, and I saw You Only Live Twice at a children's Christmas party at the Royal British Legion in Luton. And they'd had sandwiches, and they'd had jelly, and they'd had a clown, and they'd had games. And then they wheeled in this sort of 16mm projector, and I was sitting next to it. And they had a screen with a mono speaker stuck underneath it, which had a wire directly connected to the projector. And I remember all this very distinctly because I didn't know what was going on. And they put the reel on. It must have been a 16mm copy of the movie that they'd hired, rented for this event. And it started clattering its way through the projector. And then I was absolutely transfixed, because you have the gun barrel, and then you have, you sort of zoom out to these guys in space, you know, in and then being eaten by a giant rocket with, you know, the front opens up, and then they float off into space, and then you have the song, you know, You Only Live Twice, you know. So you've had the gun barrel, you've had the John Barry's like capsule in space, Space March music, which is extraordinary anyway, and then bang into da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And then, you know, I was absolutely in bits. And of course, immediately after that, Sean Connery is post-coitally machine gunned to death and then dumped into the sea. And I was 8, and I was thinking, this is brilliant. And that was it. Those things were happened within sort of 6 or 7 minutes of each other. And it was quite an eye-opener and an ear-opener. I mean, I, you know, weird thing to say, but I sort of hypnotized by it in a way. And I think it was something about the sound, the combination, obviously, of visuals and sound, but the music just really stuck with me the entire time. And there was so much classic sort of John Barry in You Only Live Twice, and, you know, the marvellous song. And obviously they used the Bond theme, you know, quite frequently during that film as well. So basically an introduction to everything iconic about it.
Because, and I know this is a well-rehearsed story, but because there, it is possible that there are still some people that don't know it. Obviously, the Bond theme that you refer to there is credited to Monty Norman. What do we know about who, about where the Bond theme, the dun-dun-dun-dun, actually came from?
Well, it was Monty's theme. Monty was working in Jamaica while they were shooting, and he was doing a lot of the in-camera stuff, because they had a lot of songs in clubs, which was sort of jump-up music at the time. And Monty was a very successful West End and Broadway composer, and had shows on and had a very successful career in that. And so I think the initial things that he came up with were the songs, Underneath the Mango Tree, which is like a great song, the arrangement of Three Blind Mice at the beginning, because there was no Bond theme at the beginning of the movie at that point.
Blind mice in a row, three blind mice, there they go, marching down the street, single file, to a calypso beat.
He had a theme from a musical called A House for Mr. Biswell, and there was a melody which he had from that, which he will famously sing, which had a lyric from a musical, which was, I was born with an unusual sneeze. And that was the backbone, the spine of the entire thing.
I was born with this unlucky sneeze, and what is worse, I came into the world the wrong way round. Bond, it's all...
Now, the filmmakers, with an eye on what was going on elsewhere, hired John Barry, who was kind of riding high in the charts with his John Barry 7, and also had written a couple of film scores as well, Beat Girl most specifically. And he had this sound, you know, like he had the kind of swinging sound and that driving Duane Eddy-ish surfish guitar thing, which was sort of dark and dangerous. And he was brought in to do an arrangement of Monty Norman's theme, which became the iconic theme that we know today. And it was all recorded, all done very quickly, all recorded in the same room at the same time. I think so much of the success of that is the sound of it as well. You know, the fact that these guys were in a room together, and it was a sort of a violent and an essential amazingly swaggering piece of music. And they, of course, they dialed that in through Dr. No, you know, whenever they could. And you know, John Barry used to say to me, he goes, like, play the theme, play the theme, play the theme. Because when you come out of those films, you certainly remember them, you know, and you realise that John has planted these things all the way through it. But that was the only thing. I think he was 27 at the time when he did it, and I think he got £250. And that was how that whole thing started. But you can hear snippets in the score. If you listen to Monty's score, you can hear snippets of other elements of the arrangement as well. And I know there's, you know, some contention about, you know, authorship, but that's been, you know, properly legally defined now, so don't have to worry about it. But if you listen to the score, there are elements of that arrangement within it as well. So I think there was lots to pick out and find. But I mean, I think John's arrangement of it is the definitive reading of it, and it certainly turned it into something that it may not have been to start off with, and presumably why the call was made.
I'm not sure whether it still is, but your Twitter profile for a long time was a picture of you standing very handsomely in a dinner jacket with an electric guitar round your neck. And I asked you about the guitar because when I was over there at your studio, you've got loads of guitars, including this replica of Brian May's guitar, which I was very taken with.
Yes.
And I said, "What's that guitar?" And you said, "That's the guitar that I play that theme on." So you had that guitar specifically so that during a concert you could play that guitar theme, is that right?
Well, the guitar is a I like, for the first sort of couple of movies that I did, it's almost like an endless journey through how can I get it to sound the way I want it. And the guitars that I always thought it was, it wasn't. I always thought it was like a Telecaster, or it might have been a Stratocaster because it had a kind of sort of nasal twang. But then I realised that actually I was remembering it rather than really listening to it. And again, like researching the show, it was actually an acoustic guitar, a steel strung acoustic guitar with a single pickup. And it was quite a fat one. And anyway, years and years and years of trying all these different combinations of things, I came across a Gibson electric guitar. I think it's a 135, and the secret was super heavy gauge strings, heaviest gauge strings you can get on the bottom two notes, because that's where all the action is, and just straight into a valve amp and nothing else, just let that do all the work, and a super heavy pick and really dig into it. That's what made the sound work for me, and that guitar was the one that I played on all my Bond films. And whenever I play it live, I take it out and I realize that that's the only thing I've ever played on it. I've never played anything else on that guitar ever, which is like ridiculous, really. So it's got two very, very, very heavy bottom strings, and the rest of them, they're only used for twang at the end. You never use the rest of them.
I love the idea that there's an entire guitar for a single riff.
Oh, it's ridiculous. And, you know, I mean, it is ridiculous, but that's just the way it turned out. I mean, I'd love to find a home for it, but I've got a few that I really like. But that one is just perfect for it, and I quite like the romantic nature of it. Just, you know, like Thor's hammer. You know, he doesn't use it for actual hammering. You know, he saves it for whacking people with. You know, he doesn't go out and put his shelves up with it. So that guitar is very holy, and whenever I travel with it, I buy it a seat as well, because I couldn't bear for anything to happen to it. You know, you see pictures of things coming back with, you know, having been run over by something, and it's just in splinters. So yes, as for a romantic notion, it's that guitar. The same like Vic, you know, Vic Flick's guitar, which I think he sold a few years ago. Obviously he played thousands of things on it, but you know, when you look at the instrument that played that original thing at that Bond session, then you think, oh, that's a bit special.
You say you've done a couple of big movies before. For those who are listening rather than watching, it's delightful to see that you've got a Stargate cap on.
Yeah, I found it. I had a bit of a clear out the other day, and I found my crew hat, which is why it's still clean. It was in a bag.
I'm so impressed that you've still got the Stargate hat, because, of course, you know, Stargate was this huge, I mean, massive, great big science fiction movie. And I know that, you know, you and I have talked about this before, but Stargate was one of those films in which there must have been a sense for you and for everyone involved that this is the chance to explore the broadest of canvases, because it's a film that, you know, it's here, there, and I mean, it is, in the best sense of the word, all over the place, that movie.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think Roland's sort of cinematic language is, let's take advantage of where we are and what we have and exploit it to however, you know, however far we can go. I mean, all of his films, pretty much apart from the Shakespeare one, have been spectacular. And
even the Shakespeare one's got a pretty spectacular, you know, cameras flying over. Like, yeah, I mean, even the ones that are low key aren't that low key.
He's never going to stop. Something's going to get blown up. But what I loved about those first couple was that, you know, Roland, whenever I spoke to Roland about anything, he was always full of what ifs. And all of these ideas came from, what if you woke up? What if you woke up in the morning and there was a spaceship covering the entire city that you lived in, you know, which was the start of the Independence Day idea. And Stargate was from, I think it was from a student film. He was saying, what if they found a key to the pyramids buried in front of the pyramids? You know, some key that unlocked it that made something else happen and you could go somewhere else as a result, you know. And it's like all these what ifs. And of course, once you do the what if, and once you leave Earth or introduce aliens or anything, it's kind of like the gloves are off, really, aren't they? I mean, it's like the all rules, you know, you have a different sort of responsibility to the music. It's not about anything sort of real. And I always remember laughing. I think I saw an interview once with someone involved in the production who was saying that Independence Day was, you know, a film about, you know, humanity coming together under a common threat. I go, well, on one level it is, but it's mainly about blowing things up. You know, it's I didn't find it as profound maybe as they did, but it was funny. You know, it was funny, and everyone had a good time with it, and I had a great time with it. But you know, Roland is a very camp in a lot of ways. You know, like his filmmaking, I find quite camp, and his characterization and the way that he shoots things, and he's very funny, you know, and sort of humorous and light and good company, and all those things make you think, oh, we can do anything, you know. It's like he hasn't got his head in his hands, you know, wondering about the Sturm and Drang of everything. You know, he wants it to work cinematically. Well, certainly in those days it was. And so we had a good time. We had a good time doing it, and thank goodness for that, because in a way, you know, Stargate was a ridiculous kind of over-the-top sort of space opera score, the likes of which I thought I'll never get to do one of those. I mean, if you think about how many films like that there's been since, where it has been sort of fantastical and escapist, and, you know, the Marvel ones are sort of a different... I find the Marvel ones to be slightly different for some reason. I don't know why that is, or maybe I do if I think about it. But, you know, where you can create an overarching music world as well, you know, in Stargate, it felt like we could create a world of music, which is recognizably Stargate. And oddly with Marvel, I find it more difficult to find the sort of center of the sort of world of Marvel music in a way, you know. It's like, I know there are some outstanding scores, but as a kind of, I suppose, a sort of shop style, you know, that some of them are quite different to some of the others, and some are more idiosyncratic than others. So, in a way that I know Bond is about one person, but there is a kind of sense of DNA of music with Bond. But anyway, maybe that's a different program.
Programming seventh symbol into computer.
Chevron one is holding. Chevron one is locked in place.
Power output at 23%.
Chevron 2 is holding.
Engage.
Chevron 2.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Of all the Bonds that you worked on, what are the cues and what's the score that you're most proud of?
I tell you the thing that I found the most, or two of the most exciting things. One of the most exciting things was when we recorded the K.D. Lang song Surrender for the first time, because it was a bit of an audition process. I was asked to score the pre-title sequence first. They were still shooting the movie. They made a call to get me on board, which was lovely. And I think it was a bit of a sort of test. We better see how he gets on. So they said, can you score the pre-title sequence? Now, whenever I write a Bond movie, I always start with a song. Whether it's going to get used or not, I don't know. But it always feels like, to me, that's the core of it. And so I'd written this song. I'd started writing it with David McCalmont, and then Don Black finished the lyric. And it was, you know, very, 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 like, kind of Bond, you know, gold fingery, big and brash and confident. And in a way, you know, if you were going to do a Bond song that was going to go bang, here we are, I wanted it to start like that. So we had sort of 4 minutes to record it at the end of this session. And it was like, this is like a demo. So I hadn't played them the song. I'd written the opening sequence, which quoted bits of the song in it. But no one had heard a song as such. So I recorded the actual song with the orchestra right at the end, and it was a one-off thing. I said, look, we're not going to use this. This is just for a demo for the song so the producers can hear it. So they sat on the edge of their seats and played it, and it was like, what was that? It was just, everything was dynamite. A couple of little fluffs here and there, but, you know, there was no guidance, really. You know, they just blew it, and it was astonishing. And everything happened at the same time, all the drums and the guitars and the bass and everything happened at the same time with the orchestra. Anyway, when it came to actually recording the song, I put the same music up on the stands in front of the same orchestra in the same studio with the same microphones and the same engineer, and nothing had changed, and just couldn't get close to that, the vibe of that first take. It was just really, really quite weird. And we ended up using that. That was the one that we ended up using. So the next time that really happened was on Casino Royale, when we deliberately held back the use of the Bond theme until we cut to black at the end of Casino Royale, when he says the word, you know, the name's Bond, James Bond. So you'd spent the entirety of that film willing it to appear, you know, and I spent the entirety of that film kind of dangling bits of it and waiting for Daniel Craig's Bond to earn it in its fullness. So whenever he had his tuxedo on for the first time, you sort of drop a little bit more. When he wins the Aston Martin in a game of cards, you drop a bit more. When he does his first flying into an exotic location, you drop a little bit more, and you're ready for it. And then by the time it comes up at the end, it's bang. Anyway, so I'd saved it till the end of the recording session. So this was, we'd recorded the entire score for Casino Royale, and this was the only thing that was left to do. And I sort of wanted to hark back to the original sort of John Barry arrangement, but it was obviously muscled up, you know, in a way, Daniel Craig's version of it. And so it was sort of a bit more aggressive, and it was fuller. There's more stuff going on. But everyone was on the edge of their seat. Like, the whole band had been waiting to play it as well, you know, because it's one of those things that when you do a session with an orchestra and you say you're doing a Bond movie, they will say, when someone comes in, they say, what are you doing? Oh, we're doing a Bond movie. Otherwise, it's just like, are we doing a movie? But they will always say, we're doing a Bond movie. And to play that tune, obviously, full out, you know, from start to finish, is a big deal. And so Barbara and Michael came down, and Martin Campbell was there, like other like producers, people from Eon and MGM, all stood in the control room. And we just played it, you know. And I was playing guitar on that guitar. And my hair was longer, and it just sounded dynamite, you know. It was just so full of excitement and energy, and it was the same thing. We went for a second take, wasn't the same. It was just that first one, it just kind of leapt off the page and everything became electric, and that recording has been used in so many things for, you know, for the contemporary Bonds, the ones that I haven't done. I think they licensed it for Skyfall. And I think for Spectre, and I heard it on the trailer. On, so you know, it's lovely to feel that it's part of Daniel Craig's James Bond, because it did feel it was written for him. You know, that arrangement was sort of written for him, but the muscularity of it and the energy of it was all down to the players. Because like I said, you know, it's just dots on pages until they take ownership of it, and you've got 85 people giving it 100%, you know, a lifetime of performance experience, and then it just moves the air about and you go, bang, that's it, thank you very much.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
That first take thing has been a big thing for you right through your career, because I remember you telling me the story about, I think, is it Play Dead?
Yeah, Play Dead.
That was a single take because you had no time left. You just did it once and that was it.
Yeah, it was a nightmare. it was a very, very low budget film. I mean, it wasn't super low budget. I mean, we had an orchestra for a day, which was, you know, quite an expense, but the money all went on the players. And we had a lot to do. And, you know, usually in these things, everyone's concentrating on the score, making sure that the score is right and working. And so written this song for the end titles. And I wanted to get the orchestral part of it recorded. And we had 3 minutes left. It's a 3 minute long song. You cannot go over time. If you go over time, you go into 15 minutes extra. And all of a sudden you're paying 65 people, you know, X amount of money to do 10 seconds of more. Anyway, so I knew we had to stop when the clock hit 1 o'clock. I knew we had to stop. At the same time, the click machine, you know, we were using, stopped working at that point. And it always happens when you've got one thing left to do and you've got no time to do it, things start going wrong. So I pulled a load of wires out of the mixing desk and I said, just play it. And they hadn't even seen it. So the players were putting the music up on the stand and it was counting them in. And they played it, all the way through, and that was what we had, and that was what it was. I mean, if you listen carefully, there are some fluffs and some flubs in there a little bit, but again, something about the energy of that, you know. I mean, it was pretty in your face, and it took a bit of work in post to sort it out and get it, you know, get it worked out. But again, you know, the energy of the performance, and I think that's probably why I like working with players more than anything, you know, because it can just change it so much.
I never understood that thing about orchestra overtime until I was doing a series of concerts once with Robert Ziegler, and he was conducting the orchestra and I was doing interviews in between, and I overran. I started talking to Paddy Considine and it didn't go short.
No.
And then we got into the last and it got into the last piece of music, and Robert conducted it like he had a bus to catch, and we came at the end of it and I went, What was with that? And he went, have you never heard of overtime? And it was like,
yeah,
oh,
it's a lot.
Yeah, you're right. If we go 1 minute over, you have to pay the entire orchestra for the 15 minutes.
Yeah,
and that's a major thing.
I think it was in Manchester. And I was there that night. Was it?
Yeah,
I think it
that
was.
Sounds
And we did an interview
on
stage.
Yeah, it may well have been, yeah.
We did an interview on stage, and I think you asked Paddy Considine, what was it like working with me? Because I'd done Hot Fuzz, you know, and he was in
That's
Hot
right.
Fuzz.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And he said, what was it like working with David? And he said, I don't know, I never met the bloke. which is true. The first time.
Yeah, well... That was the concert at which he gave me this, which again, for listen, this is the mold of Reagan's face from The Exorcist that he gave me as a 50th birthday present. Wow. And that was the concert that he gave me. And that's why the interview overran.
Oh.
Because he said, yeah, I've got something for you. And there was no way we weren't going to talk about that for a good long time.
That is a lengthy detour. With anyone, but with you, I would imagine it's a whole new holiday, yeah, that one.
So, David, having done the Bonds that you did, do you now, when you see a new Bond, do you have notes in your head for the composers? I mean, do you listen to the new Bond scores and think, well, I would have done that, or I would have done that, or how does it play with you?
No, I never do that. I watch them the way I always watch them. You know, I mean, I just watch them as a punter, and I think the one thing that I've learned, if anything, from doing films is that I now know the reasons why I like or don't like certain things. It's given me an appreciation of why some things work and how they work. And it's like, God, that was incredibly clever the way that he did this sequence. And if something is great, you kind of understand the reason why it's great. I mean, you know, I know you write about films in the same way. You know, you have to understand why things work or don't work. And you do that by informed opinion and experience. So I definitely know when something is great. You know, it's like you really think, oh, that's fantastic. But most of the time, I'm watching the film. I wouldn't listen to the music specifically. You've obviously got your ear open a little bit for it, but I just try and sit back and watch a Bond movie as it is, as I did, you know, when I was 8. You know, I wasn't really picking things apart, but you know, the music certainly stuck out. But you know, it's impossible to not have a critical ear. You know, because you're always thinking of, you know, how is this working, and also not how is it working now, but what does this mean for the next guy? You know, it's like, because every time you do something, you know, Daniel's James Bond has done something which hadn't been done before, that's going to have an impact on what the next guy has to do. So whatever anyone does with a score will have an impact on the next one, because these things are, you know, impactful in terms of the series, and you can't ignore what's gone before. I mean, we haven't had another disco Bond score, you know, since A Spy Who Loved Me, you know, that's probably because like the sort of disco faded away a little bit. There was a little bit at the end of Moonraker, wasn't there, where they did the, you know, the kind of like a Down Deep Inside mix that they did for Jaws 2, wasn't it? With Donna Summer, another John Barry song. You know, it's like a sort of disco version of it. And then they did the disco.
Well done
sort
for mentioning
mix.
Jaws 2.
Yeah,
nobody else could have got there, but well done.
Moonraker had the Shirley Bassey, you know, sort of disco-fied. So it's always moved with the times and sort of reflected other things that have gone ahead. But the last three songs, really, especially, have been sort of quite introspective. You know, the opening two, You Know My Name with Chris Cornell and the Jack White, Alicia Keys ones, were kind of door-kicking open songs, you know, that had a certain energy to them. But like Adele and Sam Smith and now Billy have done, you know, this kind of internalized Bond, which is, you know, more about the darkness in him. So that's something which we're going to have to deal with next time round. You know, whoever gets the job of being James Bond and writing the music for it, you know, that's something that has happened. So you're going to have to consider it. So it's always interesting. That's why I always love the end of a Bond movie. As long as those words come up at the end, James Bond will return, I'm happy, you know. Because from the moment it starts, it's like potentially you're about to watch the greatest Bond film that's ever been made. And what's great about it is for some people, that film will be the greatest Bond film that's ever made. Even the one that other people hate. You know, there might be like people say, oh, I really didn't like that. There's going to be an equal amount of people said that's the best one ever. I mean, it's an incredible, a large umbrella.
And so from your point of view, David, what is the best Bond film ever?
Oh, well, if you ask me what my favourite is versus what's the best, I think my favourite will always be Only Live Twice, just because, you know, I had my first dance, you know, with Bond at that tender age. And you know, that's something you can never, you know, the impactfulness of your first experience, you know, in a film with a series, you know, it's up there with the big spaceship at the end of Close Encounters on the big screen at the Luton Odeon, where no one could believe that you could see something that big when it turned over, you know, and revealed itself. Watching Alien at the Luton Odeon, knowing that he was going to come out of his chest, you know, knowing that was going to happen, and the whole cinema, which at that point was like 1,800 people, I think, screaming at the same time. You know, these things burn themselves into your experience, and so for me, watching You Only Live Twice as a tender, impressionable 8-year-old, it's always going to be the best for me.
Oh. What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? I have a confession to make.
What?
Actually, I'm a spy.
I know that.
And what's the best Bond theme?
Best Bond theme... I mean, I'm going to have to go for Honor Majesty's Secret Service, because it excuses me the song aspect of it, the lyric aspect of it, and the performer aspect of it. But it is an absolute killer tune. And oddly, working with Jack White on Quantum of Solace, he wrote Seven Nation Army to be a Bond theme. He said it because he loved Honor Majesty's Secret Service so much that he wrote Seven Nation Army. And then if you listen back to Seven Nation Army, it's following the same. He goes bam 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 down 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 bam bam ding 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 ding. You could go bam ba da over da 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 da. You could go over it, you know? But anyway, so you know, that's why Jack was like super excited to do it. So he was a massive fan of that. I mean, it's just such a killer tune. It's such a killer tune.
This never happened to the other fella.
I had a Jeff Love Plays the Themes of Bond album when I was a kid,
and that was
the one that, yeah, but I just played that over and over and over again because it was full of, you know, emotion and tragedy and excitement and everything about it. That, like I say, that crawling down. Also, just he has weird little leaps. Da 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 da. Is you know, to me, it was like it's gone to the wrong note, and yet somehow it's perfect.
Yeah, yeah, it's very upsetting. I mean, it's interesting. John's songwriting. I don't know if I ever felt like he was writing a song or whether he was just writing a theme, because when you try and sing them, they're incredibly difficult to sing. They have leaps, harmonic leaps, melodic leaps, which would work, make sense on a piano, but when you're singing them, you know, there are some really tricky stuff to make work. And you know, like Nancy Sinatra, I think, You Only Live Twice, which I love as a song, that, you know, that bridge section, and love is a stranger, you know, there's so many odd vocal things that you probably wouldn't do if you were a singer writing a song like that. But Don Black used to tell me that John, you know, when John delivered a song to him, it was like an unveiling. You know, there wouldn't be a note to change. You know, he would have done the sweating. He would have worked it out, and he goes, this is it. Write a lyric to that. And so that melody would have been there, and that would have been the end of it. No arguments.
Dave, it's been great talking to you. Now, people are going to be able to listen to the Scarlet Show. I know that the new Bond has been delayed again.
Yeah.
But the series is going to be available for Scarlet Radio listeners. Was there anything that you discovered doing that series that you didn't know before?
Well, a lot of the research, luckily, was already been, you know, had been done by John Burlingame in his quite brilliant book, which I participated in at the time. I love the stories about who was meant to do what, you know, and Johnny Mathis, you know, recording his version of Moonraker, and that afternoon John knowing that it wasn't the version that he wanted and bumping into Shirley Bassey in a bar in America and saying, do you fancy doing another one? You know, I love that. I'd love to hear that Johnny Mathis version, actually, because yeah, and there was a few. Obviously, you know, the Sinatra stories were extraordinary about he was going to do it, then he wasn't going to do it, and then Nancy did it. And I mean, that's where all the politics are, I suppose, isn't it? That's where the juice is. I mean, it's not quite as exciting when you talk about who might have played third bassoon on Goldfinger and why they didn't turn up, you know. But when Frank Sinatra says no, then that's different. Yeah, just, you know, the backwards and forwards and stuff. I knew quite a lot because obviously having worked with Don Black a lot and having hang around with John quite a lot, I knew a lot of the stories. And, you know, Harry Saltzman's extraordinarily, you know, dislike of the lyrics for Diamonds Are Forever. You know, he just absolutely hated it. And he thought it was lewd and rude and disgusting. I think John stood up and told him what to do with his opinion, as he as he very often did.
I always think lewd, rude and disgusting is a great review. I mean, it's just like, yep, just stick that on the poster and sell it to me.
Don told me a great story. I thought, you can cut this out. I mean, Don told me a great story about Born Free, that the producers wanted a song about lions, you know, and they didn't deliver a song about lions. They wanted something more universal, you know. So Born Free, just such a brilliantly naturalistic lyric, and sings incredibly well on a technical level. But, you know, the producers made it very public to Don and John that they didn't like it and they didn't want it in the movie, and gave them quite a hard time about it. So scroll forward 6 months when they win the Oscar for best song. And they're having their photo taken and they go to the governor's ball, and so John and Don are sitting there with their Oscars on the table, and the producer came over and just leans over and he says, it grows on you. It's brilliant.
Oh, brilliant. David, as always, it's been an absolute treat talking to you. I could talk to you forever and ever and ever. Thanks ever so much. I would direct people again to the...
You're going to have to.
To your Scala Radio series. It's lovely to be a fellow Scala Radio presenter with you, which I'm very proud of, obviously, since I've played with you. Please come back to the show when we're back in the BFI and when all this is behind us.
Yeah,
thanks ever so much, the great David Arnold.
Oh, thanks, Mark.
Well, there we are. I hope you enjoyed that exclusive Kermode on Film conversation with the irrepressible David Arnold. You can join David for the music of James Bond on Scala Radio every Sunday from the 18th of October to the 15th of November between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. Do check it out. It is a fantastic series. Thanks so much for downloading and listening to this Kermode on Film podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please remember to subscribe, tell your friends, and why not pop over to our Patreon page where there's loads and loads of exclusive extras. Thanks so much. Stay safe. See you all next week. Keep watching the skies.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.